It's very nice to see everybody here this morning. We have a very good crowd here, and I appreciate that very much. I know there's a lot of things that we can all do on a Sunday. There's a lot of things that the world offers to us. But the saints here at Monte Vista have chosen to gather together to give this time to God. I appreciate you being here. I know that God appreciates you being here as we worship Him, as we give Him the glory for all things. We want to make sure that we do things God's way, though. And a number of lessons that I have done this last year have focused on the way that we do things. Several lessons, in fact, have had the title of Why Do We Do What We Do? You'll notice if you look back to the things that we preached about this year that we've touched on church autonomy and the silence of the Scriptures and is silence authoritative? And really, what is authority is another thing that we've looked at. Why is it that we sing? Why is it that we're organized the way that we are with elders and deacons who do the work in this congregation and for the work that individual members have to do? And what I want to talk about this morning follows that same theme. I want to talk about church cooperation. That is to say, one church cooperating in some manner with another church that is the Lord's. The first question, of course, that we have to ask is this really that big of a deal? I suppose 50 or 60 years ago, we might have heard a lot of terms like sponsoring church and missionary society, and there were a lot of debates that happened. There was a lot of heartache in God's church over these issues that came up. There were, as Mitch put it when we were talking about this, fist fights that broke out over issues like this in the church parking lot. Is this really important today, though? Are these non-issues? Do things like this never really happen today? Is there such a thing as missionary societies and sponsoring churches? Or is it just a matter of the fact that we don't hear it in the news a lot anymore and that people don't debate it, at least in these grand public debates where 1,000 people will show up and watch the debate? Is it just that we don't hear about it anymore? Maybe that's the reason why we're just not aware of its existence. Now, I'll admit something to you freely. I had actually reached a point fairly recently that I also didn't think this was that big of a deal. Not that I thought it was scriptural to do these sorts of things, but that I had assumed that this is just something that either was not as big of an issue in churches or that it just had passed through the sands of time and it was maybe an issue from a bygone era. But the more that I've talked to other preachers, friends of mine, the more that I've talked to people, especially who've done overseas work, I think that it is in the overseas mission work where this is becoming a bigger deal perhaps than it even was 50 or 60 years ago in our own country. So I will say this, that it is very much a big deal, that it still very much is an issue of Scripture and authority and church autonomy. And if you think that it's just not a big deal, then I'll give you one more reason to consider this. That when you ignore issues like this, I think that it is as dangerous to ignore things like this as it would have been to ignore the situation near the end of the first century. When you read in a number of the epistles in the New Testament, the apostles point out that an apostasy was about to happen. An apostasy of some kind that would lead many people astray. And I think at the heart of this apostasy was a misunderstanding and mischaracterization of what the church is. The very nature of the church, at its most fundamental, at its core, what does it mean to be the church that is of Christ? And I think one of the core features of the church is this local and autonomous congregational structure. That one church does not have any authority or power over another church. That Monte Vista is its own self-contained congregation with its own leadership structure, with its own obligation to preach and practice benevolence in a scriptural way. And that there is no other church that we depend on, that there is no other church that commands our obedience. We are on our own a local, autonomous, fully functioning congregation of Christians. And yet by the end of the first century, that was not the case. And slowly but surely, you saw the seeds being planted for what would become Catholicism later on. to where the elders in one congregation begin to have dominance over other congregations in their city, and eventually their region, and eventually their country, to where there became a headquarters in Rome, with one man overseeing the operation of all congregations that claim to be of Christ. So if you don't think it's a big deal today for one congregation to have some power or authority over another congregation, you're making the same mistake that many people by the end of the first century and going into the second century had made as well. But maybe you're not familiar with the subject. Perhaps this is something that you're wondering, well, where are you going with this, Ryan? I've never heard of these things. I've never heard of these arrangements. Perhaps you were raised in an environment where this was the norm, and you simply saw these things advertised in the church bulletin every Sunday of works of the church, of things that we're participating in, and you never knew there was anything wrong with it. So what I want to do for you at this point is simply lay out some situations that I believe would fit into the category of unscriptural church cooperation. And we'll begin with this one. Let's say you have a church in Phoenix, Arizona, and let's say that church is called the Monte Vista Church of Christ. But the Monte Vista congregation hears about some kind of a need overseas. Let's say it's in Nigeria. And we know that there is another church in Nigeria, and we perhaps have heard through the grapevine that they have either a benevolent need of some kind, that there's a drought of some kind in the area, or that there's been some kind of a natural disaster or a calamity, or perhaps we hear that there are preachers in that area who need our support. So we're wondering, as a congregation, what is the best, most effective, most efficient way for us to get our funds halfway across the world to this congregation in need. But let's say somewhere along the way, a friend of yours from another church hears that we're interested in supporting the work in Nigeria. And your friend from another church presents our situation to their elders in their own congregation. And they say, well, that's something that we would like to be involved in as well. But we don't have a lot of resources. There's not much that we can do. Maybe if we send our money to Monte Vista, they already have the contacts, and they're going to be taking the brunt of the work anyway. They're going to take the majority of the financial assistance. So maybe if we take some of our money, give it to Monte Vista, and say, well, send that to Nigeria for us. And maybe there's some other congregations that join in the work as well. And Monte Vista then becomes sort of the headquarters of all of the work that's going to be done in Nigeria. And we collect money from other churches here in Arizona or around the country, and we take their money, and then we send their money to Nigeria. And again, I think from a human perspective, from an organizational human perspective, somebody might wonder, well, what's the problem with that? I don't see what the issue is with that. And let's say this one church in Nigeria gets a little bit too much money. Maybe they're given an abundance of money and their own needs are taken care of. And they think, well, what should we do with the extra? Well, I know there's several other churches here in Africa that are struggling as well. Maybe we can take some of that money that was given to us and we can disperse it to other congregations here in Africa. Now, on both ends of this situation, you have an unbiblical or unscriptural arrangement. On both ends. For one church to collect money from other churches and say, well, we're gonna do a great work. We're gonna do something in Nigeria and we'll take your money and we'll do that work. And for the church on the other end of it in Nigeria to say, well, we have now an abundance of money. We're going to go ahead and make a decision to disperse that money to other congregations. That also is unscriptural. And we'll look at some scriptures later on to back up what I'm saying, just in case you're wondering. But let's replace the churches in this. Let's just say instead of a church gathering money for work in Nigeria, let's say there's an organization here in the United States that is asking for money from churches and saying, we want to, as a charitable organization, send money to Nigeria to do some work over there. We're either going to build church buildings or schools or take care of people's medical needs, or we're going to pay preachers over there in Nigeria to preach the gospel. And this human organization collects money from churches to do that work. And again, on the other end of the spectrum,
replace the church in Nigeria with a charitable organization in Nigeria. And let's say that organization says, we collect money from churches in the United States so that we as a human organization can disperse that money to churches or Christians in Nigeria or Africa for some kind of benevolent or evangelistic work. At the home end, it is unscriptural. And again, at the other end, it is unscriptural as well. And at the core of all of it, the issue is that these are unscriptural arrangements. You never, and I challenge anybody, I honestly challenge you, if I'm wrong about this, you never find a single example of those arrangements in the New Testament. You don't find a single inference that those kinds of arrangements existed. And you certainly don't ever find a command in the New Testament for us to arrange ourselves as Christians in these kinds of situations. Or to use our resources to pool our money in this way and have the money change hands from these kinds of organizations from one to another, from one church to another. You never once in the New Testament see a command, an example, or even a hint that these arrangements existed under apostolic authority. There's some key principles that we need to keep in mind. First of all, every congregation, both in the first century and in the 21st century, has an obligation to do the work that God has given it to do. God has commanded us as the church to be the church. He has commanded us to do the work of the church as the church. And if it is the church's job to preach the gospel to the world, and if it is the church's job to practice benevolence, to help in a charitable way other Christians, then we cannot ask or form an organization to do that work for us. Essentially, we need to let the church be the church, and it is fully equipped to do the work that it was supposed to do. When you notice in Ephesians chapter 4, in verse 11, he says, he gave some as apostles and some as prophets. Certainly they did their work in the first century the way they were supposed to do it. He also gave some as evangelists and some as pastors or elders and some as teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of service to the building up of the body of Christ. He goes on to say in verse 16, from whom the whole body being fitted and held together by that which every joint supplies according to the proper working of each individual part. The point I want you to take away from Ephesians 4 is this, that when God made the church, he made the church fully equipped to do the work that it was supposed to do. And again, if it is our work to preach the gospel and to practice benevolence with other Christians, then we don't need any other structure or any other organization to do that work for us. The church preaches the gospel. Now, we individually participate and cooperate within a congregation to meet that end, but it is the church's job to preach the gospel and practice benevolence for other Christians. I don't need to send my money to a society or an organization or some kind of missionary group to do that work for me. The second key principle that I would point out is in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, when you read about the seven churches of Asia, each of those seven churches has its own lampstand. And each of those seven churches stands or falls on its own. That there is no interconnectivity between the churches. That Ephesus' problems were its own problems. And if it fell, it didn't bring anybody else with it. And the same was true if it rose, it didn't bring anybody else with it. And the point I want to make from Revelation 2 and 3 of these individual lamps is they were autonomous churches. They rise or fall in an autonomous way as well. Our work is never connected to another church's work. Our success as a congregation is never tied to the success of another congregation. And the same goes with our failure. And the moment that we take what we're supposed to be doing as Monte Vista and hand that responsibility off to somebody else and say, here, we can't do that. We don't want to do that. We're not in a position to do that. We can't afford to do that. But here, take a little bit of our money and you go do it for us. We have tied ourselves to the work of another congregation. And if we're autonomous, then we must actually be autonomous. Third, elders only have local oversight. You read about this repeatedly in the New Testament in 1 Peter 5 and verse 2, to shepherd the flock of God among you. That's local. A church down the street is not among us, just as much as a church on the other side of the world is among us. Our elders only have authority with this congregation in Acts chapter 20, verse 28. Titus chapter 1 and verse 5, to appoint elders in every city as I have directed you. Why would Titus need to appoint elders in every city? If elders in one city could have control or dominion or authority over multiple cities, why appoint elders in every city if the elders in one city can have control over multiple cities? Because church authority, elder authority, is local and autonomous and limited. Local autonomous churches sent and supported preachers in the New Testament. That is the example, that is the model that you repeatedly see. Local autonomous churches collected funds. We'll read Acts chapter 11 a little bit later on in our lesson. But local autonomous churches collected funds. Local autonomous churches had complete control of those funds until they were given for the work that they were supposed to do. And we'll read 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 through 3 a little bit later in the lesson as well. And local autonomous churches made sure that the funds collected were sent directly to the church in need. There was not an intermediary organization. We don't collect our money, give it to a human institution of some kind that then gives it to those in need. We take our money collected from our own congregation and we send that money directly to those who have the need. Nobody else touches the money along the way. There's no other money changing hands with other organizations or other institutions in that process. So let's look at evangelism a little bit more specifically and the cooperative work that tends to happen in situations today or even 50, 60, or 100 years ago in those situations that divided the church so badly. In the New Testament, only a local church has control of who preaches and teaches there. And what I mean by that is that nobody else is telling you who you have to listen to every Sunday. I am here because you want me to be here. Well, at least I hope that you want me to be here. A few of you want me to be here, and the rest of you are too nice to say anything. But the fact is that I'm only preaching here because you want me to be here. And that's the true same with everybody else. When somebody comes for a gospel meeting, he's only here because we've invited him to come. And there's never a situation where somebody else outside of Monte Vista says, listen, you need to have a guy come for a couple weeks and set you straight about something. Here, I'm sending a guy to you and he's going to preach there for the next 3 years. Okay, he's on contract for 3 years under that contract and you have to listen to him for 3 years now. Nobody else is telling you, nobody else is telling our elders who gets to preach from this pulpit from Sunday to Sunday or to teach in our classes. We have the authority within our own congregation to determine who preaches in this congregation. And unfortunately, you have a number of situations today where that is not the case. I actually was personally acquainted with one of those situations. I went to preach for a church in San Juan, Puerto Rico several years ago. And while I was there in Puerto Rico preaching for this congregation, we found out that there had been an institutional church in town that was struggling at the time. So I got an invitation from that institutional church to come preach there as well on the Sunday night. So while I was there in Puerto Rico, I got to preach for these two different congregations. And when I was there with the institutional church, the situation was that their building had been built and their preacher had been paid and all of their resources had been donated because of a benefactor in the United States. And that benefactor was a congregation. And this congregation wanted to set up a church in Puerto Rico. They really wanted to set up a church in Puerto Rico. So they paid for everything and they built a nice building, a very comfortable building. Certainly a building that was, I think, beyond the standards of most churches in Puerto Rico.
But this church in Puerto Rico wanted to have some autonomy. They wanted to appoint their own elders, and they wanted to have their own preacher, and they wanted to make decisions on their own as a congregation. And their mother congregation back in the United States did not like that. They didn't want to lose control. So they hung money over this church's head. And they said, you can either cooperate with us or we'll remove the money. We'll take the money away. And eventually they did. Their mother congregation took away all of their financial resources and set them adrift. No elders, no preacher, no teachers. And they were struggling because of that. My friends, when we allow another church to dictate for us what we're supposed to be doing as a congregation, we have given more power to that congregation than God has allotted. When we allow another church to tell us who preaches here, who teaches here, what we're to use our money for, how we're to spend our time and our resources, that is power and authority that you never find in the New Testament. Rather, in the New Testament, churches are always allowed to put to the test those who come to them. In Ephesus, in fact, in Revelation 2, verse 2, that's one of the things that John points out was really working well at Ephesus, is they put to the test teachers who come to them. And they don't just have to sit there quietly while somebody teaches them something that's unbiblical. Each church has a right to test those who come to them without accepting the orders, as I said before, without accepting the orders of a headquarters or a regional or world leader or an assembly or a synod or a conference or whatever modern day terminology you want to apply to it. We are autonomous, and we will put to the test with the scriptures anybody who wants to come and preach in this congregation of believers. Look at Colossians chapter 2. I love the way that Paul puts it here, beginning in verse 16. Therefore, he says, let no one act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day, things which are a mere shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of the angels, taking his stand on visions he has seen, inflated without cause by his fleshly mind. And look at verse 19. And not holding fast to the head, from whom the entire body, being supplied and held together by the joints and ligaments, grows with the growth which is from God. What is Paul saying there in Colossians 2? He says that we are not supplied by anybody else but Christ. We are not supplied by a conference or a synod of churches. We're not supplied by a headquarters in Salt Lake City, Utah. We're not supplied in any organizational or any financial way. And we're certainly not supplied in any way spiritually, but in the way that God lays out the scriptures. We're supplied by Christ. We are not connected to each other in a congregational sense. We have no institutional connection to any other church of Christ in the world. But we're connected to Christ because He is our head. And in the sense that each and every autonomous church is connected to Christ, only in that sense are we connected to other churches, because we're all connected to Christ as our head. But there is no horizontal connection, only a vertical connection. There is no horizontal connection here on earth from church to church. And this shows a lot of wisdom on God's part, because human institutions, whether it's a missionary society or a school or a university or a Bible tract society, human institutions always go the way of secularism and hegemony, which is just a fancy word for one group of people dominating another group of people. So you have a publishing house that dominates the churches, or you have a conference that dominates churches, or you have a university that dominates churches, or 50 years ago you have a radio program that speaks for the churches of Christ. All of these organizations, and history has shown it, all human organizations eventually go the way of secularism, and they lose sight of scriptural authority. When control over evangelism stays local and autonomous, everybody benefits.
preachers benefit because preachers are free to associate with any church they think needs them. You know, in the same way that I'm only here because you want me to be here, I think you could also say I'm only here because I want to be here. And if I didn't want to be here, I wouldn't be here. But my friends, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, I love being here. And I want to be here. And there's great work that we're doing right now, and there's great work to be done. And I want to be here for that work that we're going to do. So I'm free to associate with you, just like you're free to associate with me. And churches are never forced to accept the appointment of a preacher or an elder or any other leadership position, for that matter, by an authoritative institution. Additionally, preachers are directed, we are directly supported by churches. Whether you support me or I have other congregations out there that like my work and want to support me, so it is to the church that we are immediately accountable. I don't have to answer to another body. I don't have to answer to some other organization. I don't have to answer to a missionary society that tells me where to go, what to preach, what to do, and who to associate with. I am free to be here, just like you're free to have me or anybody else be here. But what about benevolence? I think benevolence becomes an issue as well, because we see needs all over the world. We want to participate in those needs, and we sometimes don't always have access, or we don't know how to go about doing it. Of course, the problem I think today is that because of the internet, because of the way that news and media travel so quickly around this world, maybe we're more aware of needs around the world than we ever have been before. You think in just the last year, the things that we've participated in, I mean, all the way from a flood in Mississippi to a typhoon in the Philippines, we have had opportunity to participate in helping Christians with material need. And it's good that we have. And I'm sure that those Christians appreciate any contribution that we've made to the work that needed to be done in helping them rebuild their lives. But this wasn't the case 50 years ago. Really, it wasn't even the case about 20 years ago. News simply didn't travel as fast as it does today. Now, in the Bible, multiple congregations can send aid for benevolent purposes. Let's read 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 through 3, to see a great precedent that has been set. Not only a precedent, but I think verse 2 is written as a command. Now, concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. So, helping other Christians is not an option. Helping other Christians is not an option. Benevolence is not an optional activity for the church. This is something we must do. As the churches of Galatia were commanded to set aside some of their own resources to help Christians in need, as Corinth was commanded then in verse 2, every first day of the week to lay by and store some of their resources, I believe that we too today are commanded to practice benevolence. Verse 2, on the first day of every week, let each one of you put aside and save as he may prosper, that no collections be made when I come. And when I arrive, whomever you may approve, I shall send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. So there are some things to keep in mind here. Even though many congregations, churches in Galatia, church in Corinth, could all send money for one effort, there were some conditions. Verse 3 points out one of those conditions is that you have complete control over your resources until they arrive at the destination. What I mean by that is that Monte Vista cannot take some of its own money and say, well, the Red Cross is doing some great medical work around the world. Let's take some of our money and we'll give our money to the Red Cross, and then the Red Cross is going to go out and do good things for people around the world. Or we'll take our money, and we heard that there's a church in Tampa, Florida, that's sending a guy into Africa to help out with something. Let's send our money to that church in Tampa, and then they'll take the money and they'll kind of do with it what they want. Corinth had complete control over its money. And Paul says, however you want to send the money, all right, it's yours to send, and whoever you want to send it with, you pick who you want your messenger to be. You pick who you're going to send your money with, but it's going to go directly from you to the need. Not only that, but we have a number of examples in the New Testament where benevolence is always from Christians to Christians. Even in 1 Corinthians 16, it points out that this is a collection that was to be taken up for the saints. That's the operative phrase. In fact, I'll put it this way. To the saints, or for the saints, for the brethren, is always the operative phrase used in the New Testament. And here's my challenge again, if you disagree with me on this. There is not a single example, not a single command, and not a single inference in the New Testament that churches worked as the church to support unbelievers in a benevolent work. Acts chapter 4, 32 through 35, not a needy person was among them, speaking of the Christians. Acts 11, 29, for the relief of the brethren. 1 Corinthians 16, Acts chapter 2, mentions only those that were saved who were sharing and having all things in common. Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 8, those were widows who were members of the church in Jerusalem receiving support. 2 Corinthians 8, 4, support of the saints. 2 Corinthians 9, verse 1, ministry to the saints. Romans chapter 15, verses 25 through 26, only the poor and needy who were members of the church in Jerusalem were to receive the funds being sent from Macedonia and Achaia. And over and over and over again, that is the precedent. But we'll end with this point. Our time is running short now. We want to get to Bible class. We'll end with this point. Individuals cooperate. Churches participate. But in the New Testament, you never see churches cooperating. Churches do not cooperate with each other. Individuals within a church cooperate with each other, and that's what makes us a congregation. That's what makes us a church, is that you and I as individuals, we cooperate to do the work that we're given to do as Monte Vista. You see in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, the way that the different parts of the body cooperate with each other. It takes a bit of cooperation to get food from the plate into your hand and into your mouth, right? Multiple parts of your body have to all be on board with this process in order for food to get to your mouth. Walking takes a bit of cooperation, doesn't it? One foot to the other, a sense of balance in your ears. Individuals cooperate with each other. But churches participate. Look at the phrases that are used here. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, for example. And the word that he uses here, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1. Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God which has been given in the churches of Macedonia, that in a great deal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much entreaty for the favor of participation in the support of the saints. Now, they wanted to participate in helping Christians in Jerusalem and Judea who were suffering. There was a drought, there was a lack of food in the area, and those Christians in Judea were suffering. And these Christians in Macedonia wanted to help. But they didn't cooperate with any other church in doing that. They simply said, there's a need, and we want to participate in helping in that need. And we don't need anybody else to give approval. We don't need anybody else to help us. We don't need anybody as an intermediary or a middleman. We want to participate in helping people. And Corinth was asked to participate as well. Not to cooperate with Macedonia, but to participate in the same work that they were doing. Philippians chapter 1. And this is our last scripture. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 3. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always offering prayer with joy in my every prayer for you all, in view of your participation in the gospel from the very first day until now. Philippi was commanded to participate in the work of the gospel. They were commanded to participate. And in whatever way Philippi could do it, that was all God expected from them. Unfortunately, today, our eyes are sometimes bigger than our stomachs in America. Every church in America wants to have a missions program, and every church in America wants to have a big, beautiful sanctuary, and every church in America wants to have a gymnasium and a fellowship hall, and they want to spend $1 million putting this in and that in and have a building program, and every church in America wants to have a big map where all the people around the world that they've helped. But you know what? We're not asked by God or commanded by God or expected by God to do things that are beyond our means. Especially if it means sacrificing local autonomy just so we can pat ourselves on the back and say, we did a little small part in some grand work that somebody else did for us. All we're asked to do by God is to participate in the work of the gospel in whatever way we can, whether it's in this community or any other community where we might have access. But nobody else does it for us. And nobody else is a middleman. And nobody else touches the work of God but those who are asked to do it. If you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. You have an opportunity, as you do after every lesson, every time we gather together, you have an opportunity to make your spiritual needs known, both to God and to this congregation. So whatever way that we can help you, please let us know by coming forward as we stand and sing.